Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com.
Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 104, Shake That City. Today we are joined by Mads Flo, a Danish game designer, best known for the Spotlight game. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very pleasure to be here.
It was awesome to catch up actually in person and not just be lurking in the social medias. I feel like there's so many designers I've met through social media that I had no idea they were like that far away from me location-wise.
Yeah, so I'm from Denmark and you're from the US and we just met for the first time in person at Spiel in Essen a few weeks ago. So yeah, and it was a pleasure to meet you.
So for anyone who doesn't know your like origin story, mind going into how you decided to start designing games?
I guess it's about 15 years ago now, or something like that, that I played Arkham Horror by mistake, I would say. So my then girlfriend and I, we were playing not any kind of hobby games at all. And we had some kind of holiday, I think. And we read an article in the newspaper about some new board games and they were awesome. And then we went to buy one of them and they didn't have it. It was like a pocket version of a bigger game. So we bought the bigger game, got home, and it was just too confusing and we didn't know how to play it or anything like that. It wasn't Arkham Horror, by the way. But then I tried to take it back to the store. They wouldn't take it back or anything. So I sold it online or traded it for some other games or something. And among those were Arkham Horror. And it was supposed to be like, this is when I discovered BGG, and it was supposed to be like one of the hottest big games and all that. But if you take the jump from Catan to Arkham Horror, you're just in for a big one. And we tried to play for, I don't know, I want to say 6 or 7 hours. I'm still just reading the rule book and just not getting anything right and all that. And I just thought to myself, if this is supposed to be one of the biggest or the best games there is, then I could probably make something that's better. So,
throwing some shade.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, I don't dislike Arkham Horror at all. I think it's a great game now, but back then it was just too big of a jump, right? And I didn't realize that. I didn't realize there were difficult games and more challenging games than Catan, Monopoly, and stuff like that.
Oh, no, I completely agree. My cousin, when he found out I was a game designer, and that was when I first started doing it, he's like, great, we're going to play Spirit Island on the hardest mark. Just choose your character based off of like the picture. Dumbest mistake, worst experience. One of the only games I've ever quit that was like a published game. And I feel like I have to play it again because it is such a well-renowned game.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's like life, I guess. It's like when I tell my son, he's 8, when he goes to school and all that, and if the teacher, they do some kind of testing or something, I just tell him, relax, it's just to know where you are in your development. Because if they give you something that's too difficult, it's going to be too hard for you, you're going to quit. And if it's too easy, you're not going to learn anything. It's exactly the same with people in board games and how far down the rabbit hole they are. There's always something new to discover, and this is what I love about games. And that's always something that can probably make me feel that way, a bit insecure about what am I doing, why am I doing it. But then you're in discovery mode and you discover and you find out something new and amazing sometimes.
Aw, I love that. So then when you were working on Shake That City, where did your initial inspiration come from?
Yeah, so my co-designer of Shake That City, Kåre Thorndahl Kjær, he was asking me specifically and a couple of other Danish designers as well to design games with him because he wanted to have a published game and he wanted to do it as a co-design. And he actually took time off his regular job to do this, to pursue his dream of doing this. And with me, we just clicked in the right way. So we quickly had a bunch of ideas, and one of them was something about pulling cubes out of a bag. So because there's only so many ways that you can randomize stuff in board games. So you can roll dice, you can flip cards, or you know, shuffle them, do deck building or whatnot, and then you know the list really gets very short from there. There's not a lot of ways that you can do that. And the interesting part about that in games is that that's one of the main mechanics in games that will keep players coming back for more, because there's something random, something that's to be revealed, really. And then there's the reveal, and that's surprising every time. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you can come up with a new way to do that, then you're off to a good start. And so what we did, we had the cubes in a bag, and then we pulled them out into a 3x3 grid, just one at a time. It was just tedious and boring. But by doing this, we had, and the cubes are different colors. And when you have this randomly generated pattern of cubes, you kind of also have a random generator for polyominoes, because polyominoes are also squares that are connected together, right, in any kind of shape. And even in this way, we can have it like a disconnected polyomino. So if you can imagine the three cubes in the top left corner, for example, and then you have a single one in the bottom left corner, for example, that could actually be sort of part of the same polyomino, even though it's technically two of them, but that you kind of have to keep the same configuration and everything when you place it down. So yeah, that was the main idea behind it, that we just wanted to do the randomization in a new, fun way. To me, it's new, it's unique, it's not something that you see in other games. I think we accomplished that. But what really took it further ahead was that we actually designed the box, the shaker box that's in the Shake That City, which is a device where you put in the cubes and you shake the box and then you pull a lever and then you lift it and then it has kind of pooped out 9 cubes in a 3x3. So it's done really quickly as well. So it's like rolling the dice in a dice game or drawing cards in a card game or whatever it is.
I definitely remember seeing that device and going, oh my God, that's so cool. And then realizing when I actually got to play the game that it had no plastic, that it was like a chipboard device, was really cool. Because I'm sure costing was probably really hard when you're trying to find a publisher for that game. Because I know when I pitch stuff with like machines like that, people are like, too expensive. They don't even look at it or consider it. And it's so disheartening as a designer to be like, but no, look, you could make it cheap.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess the first iteration that we had when we actually kind of sold the game to the publisher AG, or we pitched the game to them, the game did not have a very well-functioning shaker device. It was basically just a box with 9 holes in it, and you would shake it, and then you would lift it very carefully so that no other cubes than the 9 would fall out and put it gently to the side. I mean, it worked. And I guess the publisher, AG in this case, they would just say, well, that's fine. We can work with that. But we really wanted to make it better than that. So we upgraded it. And we also realized that if you have an open box like that, some people at least, when they play test it, they would think it's a dexterity game, so that they would have to decide which cubes come out of the holes by, you know, manipulating them when they shake the box, and that didn't work. So we have to put a lid on it. If you had the lid on it, then there's a bunch of other stuff that has to go on internally, but it's all cardboard and a few rubber bands, and that's it. And I think that's quite an achievement.
I thought that was so cool. And you're totally right that if they were able to see, they would 100% try to like arrange it in things. It's so funny how often I'll ask playtesters like to randomly grab something from say a bag, and then they feel around and they pick things intentionally. I'm like, what are you doing? You're cheating.
Yeah, you will just do it. I mean, of course you will do it, because if you can, you do whatever's best for you, right? You won't think of it as cheating as a player, I guess. You'll just unintentionally do it.
So how did you take the gimmick of a machine that puts out this like 3x3 pattern related to polyominoes and turn it into Shake That City, actually adding like a theme of building out like roads and factories and homes and parks?
So we already had the theme. We called it the Shaky Town, I think, when we pitched it. AG did not like the sound of like earthquakey stuff.
I was getting that vibe. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. So it had to be a bit more like a fun title, I guess. And, you know, a little bit more lighthearted. So Shake That City was what we ended up with. But the theme was already there, but the entire development of how everything should just like come together and the scoring of stuff. And we have like bonus tiles that you can flip during the game to score extra points and stuff like that. We also had those, but the way it all came together, that was really with Josh from AG. He's also the designer of Cat Lady. and Let's Go to Japan is this new game. So he was our main developer, and then we were fortunate enough that we sort of like had two of those, because I think it was like kind of midway, then we had another one. So yeah, I guess, well, how do you develop a game? I guess it's all about playing the game 200 times, and each time you just fiddle with one small rule compared to the other rule, because it's really like an ecosystem. So we have like five different things that you can build in your city. We have roads, we have parks, we have houses, we have shops, and we have factories. They all have to work together somehow. So in the scoring of how you score those, they are all connected to each other. So they're kind of linked, but it's kind of one big ecosystem that kind of like, you can think of it like a chain. So if like this has something to do with this, but then the other thing has something to do with the next thing, it's kind of hard to explain, but it really means that when you balance the game, it really has to be like spot on. Like we had kind of the option to do Cascadia style scoring in the game. So the publisher was not saying no to the idea that, well, let's have like five different ways that you can score the houses. Let's have five different ways that you can score the parks and so on. And then the game is really about when the game starts, then you will kind of have to figure out, how do I solve this puzzle? How do I gain the most points out of this? Because there's going to be some kind of imbalance in how you score those things together. So there's going to be something that's overpowered, something that's underpowered. And the player really has to kind of discover what is the best way to score things here. And that becomes part of the game. And we didn't really want that. We wanted like a perfectly balanced game, or as close to perfect as we could, that you would keep on playing again and again. And that would kind of, to us, highlight the idea of the importance of the shaker, and not like, because that's really what's new and what's random in each game. That's kind of what comes out of the shaker, and not how the scoring rules changes for every game, if that makes sense.
I feel like it's very difficult to come up with a unique new game. And so when you're able to come up with any component or piece that is attracting like customers, you've done a good job. And I mean, even in the logo in the Shake That City, you actually have like the little cubes, which I found really cute on the front of the box.
Yeah, thank you. That's also, I think, something that Ko and I thought of, I think. Yeah.
Oh, really?
So yeah, we were really big part of the development and everything with AG. So they had us on board for everything. It was really cool. I think we even found the illustrator ourselves, as I recall. Yeah.
Do you find that as a designer, you prefer to have that, not hand-holding, but like working directly and throughout the process of development? Or do you prefer to just kind of pass it off and be like, all right, great, your thing. We do occasional check-ins.
Okay, so that's a really good question. So right now I have a game that's in development from Sidekick Games. They have done Aqua. They have a game called Hutan coming up. And the third game that will be published by them in that series will be Timbo, which is a game about elephants that are migrating. And I designed that game with Danny Halstead, and he's also the designer of Aqua from Sidekick Games. They are a Danish company, by the way, or at least registered in Denmark, I guess. And the two other owners of the company, besides Danny, who is also part owner of the company, that is Asger Granerud and Daniel Skjold Pedersen. And they have done Heat, and Asger, he's done Flamme Rouge, and so on. So, I mean, they're kind of veteran designers by now.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm like, those are some decent titles. My hot take, though, I actually like Flamme Rouge better personally, but also I have not played at the full player count for Heat, so I feel like maybe I just haven't experienced it correctly.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's definitely some kind of a, like, people, they either love one or the other, but if you can get people to love a game, that's a good start. So back to your question about development. So their way of doing a game is that they will, so Danny and I, we made this game just on the side. It had nothing to do with their company or anything. And by some coincidence, we showed them the game, I think, or maybe Danny did or something. I can't remember how it happened, but they offered a contract and they want to do the game, but they said, okay, we want to actually do some kind of design on the game, not just development. And I'm like, whoa, okay, what are you talking about? So Danny and I, we kind of made a dungeon crawler. Also, kind of like a polyomino style way of moving. So you have cards with polyomino kind of movement patterns that you would kind of have to grow inside the dungeon kind of style. So that main mechanic they wanted to keep, but everything else was just like up in the air. So the way that they develop a game is that they actually just tear it totally apart and say, remove the theme, remove everything. What is the core of the game? Okay, this is the core. This is what we love. This is what they signed. Basically, they just signed the core mechanic. And then they start rebuilding the game from scratch, like really from scratch. And they just throw everything at it and just say, okay, so next to this main mechanic, if we do this, it's like if people have hammers and they only have a hammer and they keep hitting it the same spot, okay, we have something over here that we have to look at. Is this interesting, right? And they just do that over and over again. And eventually it turned into Tembo, which is now a game about migrating elephants. I have not been a very big part of that process. And it's been weird because it's the total opposite of what I experienced with the AG. So you can ask me, do I prefer one over the other? I would say both is great. But with Sidekick games, that game I just know is in perfect hands. So even if I do something, I feel like maybe I'm messing stuff up. With AG, I'm not saying that they're bad in any way. I'm just saying they're a company and that is filled with developers and they don't have designers on board, right? So that's why, or they have Josh, of course, who's also a designer. And we're very thankful and grateful that we had him. And he had some great input that we would probably not have come up with ourselves. So that's just his role as a developer, because he's also a designer, was just, I mean, that's what makes him a great developer, I guess, what I'm saying. So I just say, if I have a role to fill in that process, then it would make sense to be there. But otherwise, it's totally fine if I'm not there.
I think my personal opinion has changed through the years. I remember in the beginning, I used to be like, just take my game. And then when that happened, the game never came out. Or when I'm working on it, I'm like the reason it gets pushed and comes out so fast. So now I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I like being involved, but then it makes it hard because then you can't start working on like next projects if you're still working on development of previous projects. And I'm someone who likes to work on as many new things as I possibly can because I have a problem focusing on one thing.
I would say I probably kind of over-focused, like micromanaging not important stuff, something that you can really get caught in when you get into the development of a game, because it's really small stuff sometimes, but it feels like big stuff when it's your baby that's kind of on the operating table and you're like, whoa, you've got a scalpel. What are you doing?
Oh, yeah. I still home rule one game that came out because I wasn't a part of like the end development. And I was like, no, I don't like this or this. And so I like, don't do it. I'm a little stubborn, though.
I understand.
That's so funny. So how did you guys end up connecting with AEG to get Shake That City made?
So this was during COVID and everything was like closed. Nothing, like no conventions, nothing. And what are those guys called? There was like something called the Pitch Project. And it was made by Sen Fung Lim and the other guy, and they co-designed In the Hall of the Mountain King, I think, together, and other, like, okay, so they've got like a huge portfolio of great games, and they made that pitch project thing where you could upload a sell sheet of your games, and then they would invite a whole bunch of publishers to be on a live stream, and then you would have like 5 minutes or something if your game was picked, and then you could sort of like pitch it online to, I don't know, like 20 or 30 or how many publishers who were interested in that particular style of game. So I think there was like slots for strategy games or like heavy games and family games and party games and stuff like that. NAG was part of that, but they actually already reached out before that because we've showed them, I think, a sell sheet, or we had a meeting with them. So they already was interested in the game, but we told them, well, you're definitely somebody we want to work with, but there's like huge companies like Hasbro and stuff like that that was on the pitch project. So we just told them, well, can we just wait at least until we've pitched it on the pitch project, because now it's already been picked and we have a time slot and all that. And they were like, yeah, sure, fine, that's okay, that's totally cool with us. To that extent, I just want to also say thank you to AG, because they've been honest with us with so many things and shared things that they didn't have to, and allowed us to have impact on things that I think most other new designers would not be allowed to fiddle around with.
That's so nice that they were able to do that. Also, it's cool that they let you continue to pitch, because I mean, it's one thing if they like gave you a contract and then you're like, hey, give us some time. I don't know how that whole actual conversation went, but just getting the experience of doing these like speed pitching or like submitting and getting feedback has been so valuable. I know personally to me, because it's like you're basically getting a bunch of blind play tests or like experience and just what might be wrong or could be tweaked about your game. Also, funny enough, I played Shake That City with Tanya, who does inventor relations for Hasbro, when I was at Matricon, which was a wedding convention. So that was the first time I played, and it was with Hasbro, so that's funny.
Oh, that's really funny. Yeah, Tanya, she's a very, very nice person.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart. So you also talked about how the game started was with you and your co-designer. For you, do you prefer to solo design or co-design?
I will say to co-design by quite a lot, a big margin. I do solo designs as well. It's not that I don't want to do it, but in some cases the idea is just so simple and I already kind of fleshed out the entire game and think, well, maybe there's some input here, but it would be like on a very, I'm a playtester-ish level that I could get, and I just feel like I'm not changing the core of this. That it is what it is, right? In most other cases, I would say co-design. Maybe I'm just super lucky that I have core to co-design with, because I'm sort of like the person who can come up with 10 ideas in 30 seconds and he's the one who shoots them down, and I don't do math very well, and he's like, let's do a spreadsheet and figure this out. And so we kind of just overlap with our skills a lot, and I really like, it's kind of like a philosophy, because, you know, how do you, when you're two or more designers, how do you decide who did the most, or, you know, who's entitled to what percentage of the royalties or whatnot? And to me, and to Cora, I know as well, it's not a question of who did the most work or anything. Like, if you ask anybody in a group project, how many percentage of the work did you do? And you add those percentages up, it will always be more than 100. People, they always think they do more than they actually did. And that makes sense, because there's always, like, a good game should have more than the, what is it, like the value of the whatever it is, right? If I'm doing a game and I think, well, it's 90% there, and somebody else, a designer, comes in and they kind of fix that and they add the last 10%, which makes 100% of the difference whether the game gets signed or not, then those 10% is just as important as the first 90%, right? Even if it's time-wise much smaller investment than the 90%. And the same goes the other way around, of course, if it's me who delivers 10% and so on. So I think this is what most designers should do if they do co-designs. And then they can just sit down and say, yes, let's just split the royalties 50-50. That's easy to do. And you don't have to get into an argument about who did what and who's entitled to what, because I don't think there's any good solution to that where everybody feels like super satisfied afterwards. I think you'll always have the slight hint of, did I get what I deserved, right?
Yeah, that's so interesting. I feel like I've struggled with this as like a co-designer, because I very much am the person that does a lot of the work, and then I'll be stuck kind of like at that 90%. I'm like, oh, there's just like something. And then I'll reach out to people and be like, hey, so I'm lead design, you're like this. And it's like royalties do tend to go more my direction, because I have a harder time with repeat. It makes more sense when it's like, oh, this partnership is going to produce multiple games, but I'm not as lucky as you. I haven't found that, my like soulmate co-designer yet. Still looking.
I mean, and when I say it like this, I don't invest that much time in. I see some of the posts that you do, and I see some of the prototypes that you've like been playing at different conventions and stuff. I would say that you put probably more time and effort into getting all the way there. I mean, it's a different philosophy if you try to get all the way there yourself from the beginning, because then I think you really put a lot into it, right? Rather than saying from the beginning, maybe I'm just starting out and I have most of it laid out, but can you help me with the last part? And yeah,
I'm always interested to see, because I do have co-designers where they just do 50-50 regardless. Like, that's just their deal on no matter what they work on. So like one person could literally have playtested the game once and then they still get 50-50. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? It works for each person.
Yeah. I mean, Cole, he had a game that is probably the most sought out after game of the prototypes that we've just showed in Essen this year. He's been calling it our game for a very long time. And at some point I was like, maybe I've played this once. I mean, we've talked about it. I've given you some input, but I don't feel like this is not a mess and a core game. This is a core game. So that was his game. So I just told him that. He agreed, right? So it didn't make sense to call it a co-design at that point. So that also happens when we design. So again, that's different, right? From if he had made this from the beginning.
I totally get what you mean, because I think that's great that you had the relationship where you could be like, hey, I just don't feel comfortable because I didn't feel like I gave enough for this to be a co-design. Like, I am happy because we are friends or because we've worked on other projects to give, like, opinions, kind of like a playtester, because there are times where a specific playtester will, like, make a suggestion that just, like, fixes your problem. But you don't just say, great, you're a co-designer.
No.
Yeah, no, and, like, one of my earliest games I ever made, I had a playtester make it a suggestion, and I was like, oh my god, yeah, that, like, solved one of my problems, and then from there I was able to fix it, and he's like, great, I'm a co-designer, and I was like, what? And at the time, I was, like, knew a girl, and he was, like, a well-known dude. And I'm just like, okay. But I'm like, that's not how that works. And now I'd be like, no.
Yeah. Obviously not.
I think that's, like, there's intricacies to co-designing. But I think it's great when co-designers work out really well because it's an awesome springboard. I think you can move a lot faster because you have someone to bounce ideas off of. You can split up the playtesting. I also have the same weaknesses as you. Like, I'm okay at math, but I'm not great at it. So having someone who is the more spreadsheet math heavy designer is always good. Like, my scoring systems, I like partnering with other people to double check, like, what I think is good, because they typically have a better suggestion. But good about the fun, I can find that easy in the gimmick and marketing and going to, like, all the conventions. So it's like I do a lot of the hustling where they can, like, balance out the spreadsheets.
So the creative process of the not mathy stuff, that's like, sometimes it's like what is more focused on, because that's probably what brought up maybe most of the core idea of the game. And then the mathy stuff is not often as well recognized, if that makes sense. So that made me feel a little bit like, and Core, he's also told me that, because he's not gotten a game of his own published yet. So I'm 100% sure that this new game that he's made will get published, and it's going to be his game. And I'm going to be so happy for him when that happens, because that would be like me designing a game with a, like, very intricate, I don't know, scoring system with combos or stuff like that, where I've really just sat down and said, okay, I'm doing it. Right. So he had this really great idea for that game. And yeah, even though we don't have the skills, or we say we don't have the skills, of course we do have them, but it just takes more effort or more tries. And you can kind of feel like both people are an engine and now you're going twice as fast or something like that. Just makes so much sense to co-design.
Definitely. Yeah. And I'm not saying that both of us can't do it, because I have a few solo games that I designed, but yeah, it definitely takes longer. And the nice thing is that's also what developers are for, because I, in pitches, and I'm not sure if you do the same, but when I'm pitching a game, I'm always very honest about, like, how far along I think it's done. What are the areas I'm still testing? What are the things that they need to check on? And a lot of times I'm like, hey, I'm pretty sure the card counts are good. I think that the point system is fine, but, like, this, and this, like, these I'm not 100% sure on, and they can, like, do it themselves normally, because typically, you know, publishers have their own in-house development, or they contract outside studios or individuals. So it's like, that should never stop a designer from, like, trying to make those kinds of games, because there are so many ways that they can be a solo designer or even a co-design team that maybe is lacking in one area or another. Like, I have a graphic design background, so my UI always looks good for my prototypes. It makes sense because I can do that, even if I use, like, clip art or if I make my own art.
Yeah. And I mean, it's totally fine if you're a new designer and don't feel like you have particular skills. It's totally fine to make a game with basically a hole in it, right? It's like, this is not working, but these other parts are working, and I think there's a great game here, but I need help with this. I'm going to get to that. It's not finished yet, or whatever it is.
Yeah, as long as the core is good. Clearly, as you signed a game that got gutted to the core and then rebuilt into some elephants wandering.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah, so yeah, I said new designer, but I think you can even get more and more away with doing that the more experience you have, because people will know, okay, you've had other games published and that has systems or whatever of that type or whatever. So of course you can do that, or we can make it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, there definitely becomes a privilege in having a game or two with your name on it. It makes the whole process a lot easier, which in some ways is awesome, but it's also like, oh man, to start at zero is not fun.
So a question for you. So since I follow you on social media, I've just seen a lot of your pictures, and I've seen this game with, is that the one that's going to be coming out called Balls, maybe? with a upright standing acrylic sink.
Yeah, with the like Plinko and the little marbles and stuff. Yeah, so it actually currently is called Balls. When it was signed, it was called Gumball. But we just kept calling it Balls and we're like, oh, I think this is actually going to be the name. The publisher, I'm pretty sure, is calling it Balls. I don't know if it's going to be with a Z or an S or an exclamation or like what. But yeah, it is called Balls. A lesbian made a game called Balls.
That's nice. And you remember that, right? It's a good story.
Yeah, no, that one's cool. That got signed by CMYK Games. And that was also a similar thing where me and my co-designer, Tam, so I can't build that Toyetic machine, but he has a makerspace lab and stuff. So I asked him to partner with my idea. He built it. And then as we were fussing with it, creating the game is when it got signed. Because it was like, oh, they saw the gimmick of it and they told us like, hey, but we want it to be like this. And so turned it into a co-op game. Now it feels like a classic game that has been out forever. But now they're like, okay, but now we want to add a little bit extra so there's more replayability. And so that's where we're currently at in the development of it. But I'm very excited for when that game comes out because it'll be my most Toyetic game. For that, I had a game called Cluckle that's like a rubber chicken that you shoot a die out of its butt. Yeah. That one's really cool and kind of a similar idea of like we came up with this cool gimmick and someone signed it for the gimmick and then we built the game they wanted around it. So we're very much designing and developing.
Well, I really love the, just when you see that game Balls, when you see it on the table, it's just got, I want to play with it.
No, yeah, everyone wants to play with it. It is very TikTok Instagrammable. And the amount of innuendos, like, because we have pegs, we have putting your hand in a sack, we got blue balls, like, let's go. Okay. Fun fact of my design, I try to slide in either like dirty jokes or gay jokes in almost every one of my games. So when you play a game, see if you can find some of those. Even like a National Geographic game I have like the blue-footed booby in it because it's a funny name. And I have like rainbow for the clue part of the logo. And even in the second game of it, it's going to also still have like rainbow, but it'll look like charcuterie board because it'll be Secret Clue Cuisines. So it's like, yeah, I try to like slide in some Easter eggs into like every game I work on.
That's so nice. Why haven't I thought about that? Now I have to do that as well.
I feel like you need to start doing that. Yeah, figure out what is your core things. My core things are gay and dirty jokes. Just put it in your games.
Sorry, I just wanted to add that I only got to play it once, but I played Caution Signs because I got the last signed copy at Speed, and I brought it back and I have not had any like playgroup or anything since. So, or game night. So I had to play it with my family. So that means my 8-year-old son, who's also Danish and not like very good at English yet, and my wife. And it worked wonderful. We changed it up a little bit. So we had 60 seconds to draw our drawings instead of only 20. And we reduced it to 30 by the end of the game. And that worked very well. And we added a couple of cards. So it wasn't too easy to guess as well. But we had so much fun. My wife, she did a ghostly horse, I believe it was. And it was just like, okay, so she drew a very sad horse, I guess. And it just had very long ears or very long hair. And we couldn't figure out what it was. So, of course, it was just like a bed sheet, but it was all black, you know, so we couldn't see it was a bed sheet on its head. So it was a ghostly horse and we just laughed and laughed and laughed. Many other examples, but that was really, really fun and it worked even better than I had expected it would. And I had been looking forward to playing it since, I don't know, 6 months ago, probably when I saw it announced for the first time. So congratulations on that. I think it's going to be doing very good.
Aw, I appreciate it. The nice thing is hopefully it'll be localized in your area because we had a lot of really good meetings because a lot of people saw it getting played and saw the potential or have seen me on social media playing it for like a year through playtesting, which I don't know about you as a designer. I feel like people fall into like one of two categories. I'm someone who very much likes to share the projects and like how they're developing on my social media, like even if it's just in my stories, a lot of people watch those. Or there's the other side where people are like, no, secret. Like, this is just mine. No one else gets to know about it. Unless you like play it in person at conventions.
I guess if you're more of a extrovert person and you do more social media posts and whatnot, it would be natural to include those, I guess. I try to make social media posts like regularly, but sometimes it's like 2 months between the last time I did one. So, and it's not because I don't want to, it's just that I forget to take pictures and I don't really document that much what I do on my social media. I think I'm just more like introvert, but when other people mention my game or something like that, I have no problem just resharing and say, wow, look at this. And so that makes it easier, I guess, when it's not something that I have to kind of do. But I think it's really lovely. And I guess if you hadn't done that, I haven't really noticed your games and maybe not you as much as I otherwise would have. So I think it's great that you are so active with showing your games and what else you do in your life on social media. So, yeah.
So I've talked to different designers about this, and like Daryl Andrews is very similar, where he posts like a lot of pictures of what he's doing, but not typically his own designs though. So you don't see a lot of pictures of him playtesting, but you'll see him posting pictures of playing like published games. It's one of those things that like you tend to be in the front of someone's mind if you're like constantly on their feed, and just also just showing like it becomes like a resume of like, hey, these are all the types of games this person can make. So when those bigger companies like Hasbro are like trying to send out a wish list, they like send it out. So like, I'm working on a project that I'm hoping they'll sign because it's part of their wish list, and I came up with an idea and had a co-designer that like similar brains are like, let's try this. We've never done a game. We have no published games together, but we're going to see if this like little project works. So back to Shake That City, how long did it take from that initial like inspiration of your co-designer being like, hey, I want to make this, like put out the cubes and then you build these polyominoes, to it actually being published and people being able to play the game?
Yeah, so I guess that's atypical because it was like a Corona lockdown signed game. I want to say 2 years. It's probably close to that, I guess. Maybe 2.5. I don't know. Maybe it's 3. I can't honestly remember. It's like, it's just too, I don't know, foggy or whatever it is about that period, because I don't know, it was locked down and my answer. But it's like two years is what I want to say.
It sounds like the pretty standard time.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it was too crazy or anything like that. People are surprised sometimes when you say, oh yeah, I just signed this and it's going to come out in 2027. And they're like, what? It's just the way it is.
When I try to talk to newer designers about that, I'm like, hey, well, keep in mind, publishers are already working on other games. So there's already a queue. If they do things internally, it's like, well, their graphic design team is not only working on games, but they're working on like the marketing stuff. They're working on anything that's needed for like conventions or like social media. If they're doing like Kickstarters, they're working on the page. Like, so your resources, you have so many resources. It can only be put into different areas. And you have a queue of different games that are coming out. And also, depending on how far along your design is how quickly it might jump the line. Like, I have been ridiculously lucky. And in like 3 years, it'll be about 10 games out, because my games, I was able to build them quickly, put them in a way that they could be produced fast and like jump the line. So most of my games have just happened to jump the line, which happens if like you can fill a gap that they're looking for, or it's like just a card game. Card games are easier to produce than my balls prototype, which that's the reason it's going to take a while, is just like figuring out how to make it cost effective. So you're not buying a kid's game that's like $40. But yeah, no, it's all a thing. When you were working on Shake That City, did you have like a favorite experience and then like a least favorite experience of the design?
I think just the eureka moment where we realized we have something new here. Nobody's done this before. So when you design games, that's really what you really want to do, is like you want to innovate, but you don't want to do it like too far outside of the box, because then people are just not going to connect with it or think it's a game or whatnot. I usually bring up an example, which is Klask. I don't know if you know it. It's a Danishly. Yeah, so.
Oh, of course. I went to their sausage party at Essen.
Yeah, yeah.
No joke. Like, it was called Sausage Party. Nice. I flung sausages.
Yeah, they're good at making jokes at Klask. But this is a Danish carpenter who made this game, and now this is his company. This is his life, right? And this is a title that it's kind of like what you call it, foosball. Is that what you call it in America? So like table soccer. Kind of got that vibe.
I would have related it to air hockey more than foosball.
Yeah, air hockey. Yeah, that's really what I was trying to say. But it doesn't require, like, you don't have to plug it in. It's not a big table. You just put it on top of another table. And it filled in a void, you can say. Or I want to use the expression that it's like a blue ocean title. Because it's like, it's a ship. It's sailing out onto waters that are, like, uncharted. And nobody else is in that space. So you just kind of own that space. And you don't have competition. It's like, if people want to play Klask, should we play Klask? Or should we play, and then silence? Because there's no other game exactly like it that you could play in the same way. Of course, you can play air hockey or foosball or whatnot.
Yeah, but that takes like a lot of space in your apartment or house.
Exactly. It's not a board game experience.
Yeah, it's kind of like Crokinoe. I love Crokinoe, but it's also like this bigger board that you have to keep.
Yeah, huge board.
And I mean, I love it. I found out that some people have like really fancy designed ones and they have it like hung on their wall. And I was like, damn it. If I ever get a nice house that I actually trust the walls to hold things, I'm going to upgrade mine.
Yeah, yeah. I want one too, but where to put it, right? If you can invent Crokinole and make it as a tabletop game, you're probably good for life. So the question was, oh, least favorite moment? Was that something like that? Yeah, so the favorite moment probably was when we realized we have something new here. Least favorite in the design phase, maybe it was probably setting up all the, like we had to make my kitchen into a studio to pitch the game. It was a fun experience, but it was also like we're sweating and, you know, I had like studio lights. It's like so hot.
That's just so cute. I'm like imagining you like pushing everything away, setting up this like Hollywood-esque video station on your kitchen counter.
Yeah, yeah. Like big lamps with a lot of watt and just a lot of heat. And yeah.
Amazing. Well, we were talking, we kind of talked about like different advice as far as like co-designing and just like working on the project. But in general, as a designer, do you have any advice for like newer people trying to get a game signed or working on maybe a more physical product, like your little shaker thing that you'd want to share?
So yeah, I meet a lot of new designers. We have a lot of those in Denmark. And I'm just fortunate that I've been around for, I don't know, 15 years now while the community has been building. So I started a Facebook group, I want to say 12, 13 years ago, something like that. And we have 2,600 members in it right now, which is a lot for Denmark because we're like 6 million people.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is the Facebook group? So anyone who's listening, if they're in that area, can join.
Yeah, so it's called Spildesign. But yeah, so I used to be an admin in the group, but I actually left it at some point because it's just not for me to kind of moderate and behavior stuff. And, you know, maybe I wasn't being on my best behavior and other people weren't. And, you know, so it's just got too meh, 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 meh. So I just decided not to spend any more time with it. I'm still very much active within the community, and I host design retreats in Denmark. I've been a judge of one of the competitions that we have for board game designs and all that for a couple of years. Maybe it's like 5 or something. And so I meet a lot of new designers, and I think my main advice would be when you are treated like you're making food. So you don't want to put all the ingredients that you love into the same soup. So you don't put like meat and potatoes, that's fine, and maybe a can of something.
But don't add some chocolate.
Don't add chocolate, don't put like pudding in there, but treat it as like, okay, if I have like 2 ingredients and I think these could mix well, but it hasn't really been tried before, maybe there's something there, try to do that instead of adding everything into the same pot. I think a lot of new designers think, I like this, I like this, I like this, I like this, so my game should include all those things. Rarely works. It's a too complex soup.
No, I think that's a good piece of advice. And do you have any games that are coming out in the future that you can talk about and share so people are looking?
Yeah, sure. So I already talked about Tembo, and that's a year and a half out. In the meantime, people should check out Hutan from the same company. That's not my game, but it's advertising. And games for me. So Core and I, we will have a game with marbles, sort of. I think they will be made out of wood, though. So it's wooden balls. Yeah, so you've got balls, we've got wooden balls.
Hey, mine might be wooden. We don't know yet. It could be glass, could be plastic, okay. Could be wooden.
Yeah, all right. So this is from Cosmos. It will be in a bigger box. So I think it will be in the same line as Drop It, if you know that game. It's also got like the stand-up plastic.
Yeah, and you can have the same colors touch and yeah, and the different shapes, and you get different points for being in the different levels of it. Yeah, I played it as soon as everyone's like, balls is like Drop It. And I played it, I'm like, no, it's not. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, no, not at all. I don't think they're similar. Well, they might look a little bit similar because they also have an upright.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like what caution signs people on social media are like, you just made Pictionary. And I was like, have you played Pictionary in this game? They're totally different. It just has drawing in common and words on cards, which is most games. Sorry, continue. You're talking about games coming out.
So in that game, and I don't really know what the title will be because there will be one title for the German market, I think, and one other title for the English speaking market. So who knows exactly which title will go to which place. But it should release in the spring or summer of next year. And in this game, we kind of were inspired by Candy Crush and games like that. So each player will have their own little marble tray with 5 lanes in it. And it's just basically a box with 5 lanes in it that's slightly tilted, so it uses gravity. And then you will choose some of these marbles and you will drop them in from the top into these lanes, in specific lanes, of course, that you have to do, depending on what you pick. And then they fall down. And if you have three or more of them connected next to each other, they will sort of like pop and you remove them from the tray. And then you score points. And the points are also kind of dropping down. They are laid out on the table, so they're kind of falling down as well, the same way as the marbles. And that's really the game, I guess. It's one of those simple games that took a long time to get exactly right, but now I think we hit it like spot on, just where it needs to be.
And that's a publisher that's still on my wish list, so I'm jealous of you.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just one of those logos that you see on boxes, that I've seen on boxes since I was a child. So that's just when we had that signed, it was like, whoo, we're here. We made it.
Yeah. You're like, oh, just please come out. Because as we know, games can get signed, get art, and still not come out, which is scary. But I feel like you're probably safer with that company because they're not like a Kickstarter funding kind of company.
Yeah, no, I think that's a definite release. I don't think they will pull that back for any reason.
It's awesome. Got a lot of cool stuff coming out. For my last question of the podcast, unrelated to everything we've already talked about, if you could have designed a game that you were not the designer of, which game would you have chosen?
I will have to pick two, I guess. For my first pick, I'll pick Jenga. That's just because it's so simple. It has so much to offer for what it is. There is this tension that just builds up, and then, wah! You know, everybody's like, what happened? And a huge mess, and let's do it again. And of course, it's out since I don't know when, but that's just a game that will not go away. It will be here in, I guess, a million years if we're still here.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're a Jenga fan, I don't know if you've watched the TED Talk that Leslie Scott put on, but highly recommend. It's pretty short. I think it's like 15 minutes. So you should watch that on YouTube.
Oh, I haven't watched that. I'll definitely watch that. So the second game would be Codenames. And that's just because I think people don't think of it as a quiz game, but I think of it as a quiz game where you have to think inside the heads of the other players, like Dixit, but in a more intricate way, I think. And it's just such an elegant and brilliant design. And I think if I would have designed that, I would just be fine not ever doing any more games. But I wouldn't know how to top that, I guess.
No, I am a huge Codename fan. I love deduction games. And I was actually just on Codenames Live, where we epically lost in the most hilarious of ways. But really, the winner was, you know how if you accidentally miss and you get that one guy, the assassin? So yeah, we got assassinated a lot. And turns out in the future, probably should have a partner not be from another country, because some words mean different things to us.
Yeah.
Like, we were about to win and I was trying to get them to guess lawn. I said house, not realizing the assassin's one was flat and flat could be like a house. And I was like, oh crap. And we got assassinated.
Flat. Yeah.
We were good entertainment, but we were bad. So bad. But no, that's a great game.
So what was that, Codenames Live? Is that like a new show they have?
So it's been going for quite a few years. It's through Twitch, but then they also like will put it on YouTube and stuff. So yeah, they just like invite two teams. I got to be a plus one. So it was Michelle, like the Treasure Bell on Instagram. So she got asked to be on the show. She got to pick someone and she dumbly chose me, but we were very funny. So they want us back.
That's another way to win.
Yeah, exactly. Just be entertaining, because they don't actually care who wins or loses unless it's like an actual competition. So the episode was funny. I used one word that got me like five cards and made everyone laugh their butts off. I used the word kink, and turns out that works for a lot of cards. And we were not playing the After Dark version, so
no.
It was good. You also do a speed round, so try like reading everything and coming up with a word in 7 seconds is not easy. So that's where words like that comes out of my brain fast. It was a great time. So I also really appreciate that game and all the cool stuff they can do from it. Like, now they have an app, which is different from like their website. So you can play it yourself, or you can add your friends and do that thing where you like take turns whenever you log into the app. I love deduction games. Deduction games are awesome. Well, this was super fun. I'm glad I had you on the show. And for everyone who's been listening, this was episode 104, Shake That City. And thanks again for being on the show. For anyone trying to find you on like social media, where can you be found?
Well, I'm on Facebook, but you can't find me because my last name is weird. I'm on LinkedIn, I guess, if you're a business person. But otherwise, I'm on Facebook. But you can probably type in Shake That City or something and find my social media if you just do it on Google.
Do the Google. Perfect. And I'm your host. I'm Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me on social media to check out like all the games I'm working on, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky under the username Token Gamer, and that's GAYMER. But I'm also, yeah, I'm on Facebook, and my website, dmarcreativegroup.com, has all my games. So check it out. And thanks again for being on the show. This was super fun.
It really was. And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, inspiration to publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at Let'sAllPlay.com. Join us next time.